Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
New Books in Economics, brought to you by EAEPE, the European Association for Evolutionary Political Economy.
Welcome to this new episode of New Books in Economics. Today we talk about a new book published in 2015 by Elger, and this book is titled Post-Keynesian Economics. I will give now the word to its author and to a colleague of ours that is also with us discussing the book today. My name is Andrea Bernardi, and I am from Oxford Brookes University in UK. What about you, Mark?
Well, my name is Marc Lavoie, and I'm the author of the book. I used to teach at the University of Ottawa. I was there for more than 35 years. And since 2016, I now have a senior research chair at the University of Sorbonne Paris Cité. And indeed, I teach at the University of Paris 13.
And we're here also with Danny Lang, again from Paris. Danny?
Yes, so I'm Danny Lang. I'm an associate professor in Paris 13, and I'm also a part-time professor in Louvain-la-Neuve in Belgium.
Very good. Thanks, both of you, for being here. Let's start from the title, which is Post-Keynesian Economics, New Foundations. So what is Post-Keynesian Economics and why we need new foundations?
Well, first, in English, it's Post-Keynesian Economics. The Italians have the habit of saying it the other way. Post-Keynesian Economics is a school of thought which is part of the heterodox schools of thought. There are many, many more. For instance, the institutionalist or the Marxist. And basically, this school pretends to have a different view from the mainstream Keynesians. They have a different methodology. They have different objects of analysis. And they are inspired mostly, of course, by John Maynard Keynes, but also by some of his contemporaries like Mikhail Kaleski, and also by people who soon after Keynes left were luminaries at Cambridge University, such as Nicholas Kaldor or Joan Robinson.
And why new foundations are needed today?
New foundations because in 1992, so 22 or 23 years before, I had also written a book on the foundations of post-Keynesian economics. And I thought 20 years later, it would be good to write a completely revamped and extended version of this book that would give that would show what is the state of the art with respect to this school of thought.
By the way, we are here in Budapest at the 29th EAEP conference. EAEP is the sponsor of this channel, and the book was awarded yesterday night as the best book of the year. And the award is named after Myrdal, so this is the best book, the Myrdal Prize 2017. Tell us something about the structure of the book.
Well, the structure of the book, there's a long chapter on methodology. What's the difference between heterodox economics and orthodox economics? What's the difference between post-Keynesian economics and the other schools of thought? Why we should not be convinced by the empirical evidence provided by the mainstream economist? And then there's a couple of chapters which are devoted more to the economics of the consumer behavior, the economics of the firm. So that's the micro part. And then the rest is essentially devoted to the macroeconomics. So everything about money, employment, growth, international relations, international finance. And then there's also, of course, about inflation. And at the end, there's a little discussion about ecological economics.
I would like to ask, Danny, I hope not too difficult question, which is, we know that within heterodox economics, there are several schools and at times conflictual. So how do you position yourself with respect to Marx's work and this book?
Yes, so maybe I must say that myself, I am in charge of one of the research area of EEP, which is macroeconomic regulations and institutions, where we try to mix the different approaches. But myself, I'm rather a post-Keynesian economist, even if some parts of my work are more institutional. But I'm mainly a post-Keynesian economist, so... And I got very interested by this book, even for my own lectures, because usually I don't use textbooks. And this is the first time I'm really happy about the textbook. So the paradox is that for undergraduate students, I don't use textbooks because I'm really unhappy about the textbooks, especially the ones in French, but not only. With the exception of Snowden and Wayne, I think this book is not so bad. But this time I found my textbook and I use it for my master students, for my master classes. So I myself, I'm a post-Keynesian economics, and I think this is the most complete book ever on post-Keynesian economics. And I don't say that because Mark is my friend. I believe it. And it's clear, it's complete. And I discovered some things in chapter 7. Which is on international macro. I discovered, for example, the thesis of the Banque de France, that also called the compensation thesis, which is a kind of international version of the endogenous money theory. And I discovered other things in that book. It's very complete. It's very interesting and very stimulating intellectually. And from my point of view, it's also open-minded to other schools of thought. So it's worth at least taking a look. And when you take a look, you read the book.
Well, thank you, Danny. You're very kind.
No, but I think so.
But this is why I told you. Won a prize yesterday night.
Yeah, but I'm not surprised. It's well-deserved. And moreover, I must say that the second version, the one you are talking about, you don't have the typos that you had in the first version. So I have to be nasty also a bit there.
Okay, I think that for our listeners, probably we cannot go too much into details. But probably the introductory chapter is more than enough. And this is called Essentials of Heterodox and Post-Keynesian Economics. And there is a lot about the assumptions that characterize an approach or another. I don't know if you want to go through all of them or the most important of them.
Well, maybe I'll just speak about what perhaps is the most important. It's the issue of realism. In heterodox economics, realism is very important. I mean, what we wish to describe is the world as it exists, rather than the world, some kind of ideal world that is completely abstract. And so this is a key feature. In heterodox economics, you want to be able to tell a story that fits to the facts. You don't want to describe some hypothetical world that exist only in the minds of our some of our mainstream colleagues.
If I may, when I use a book for my students of the Erasmus Mundus master degree called Economic Policies in the Age of Globalization. And what is amazing is that I can use it to show economic theory with the mathematics. And then at the exam, I can raise questions related to real world politics. For example, one of the questions last year of my exam was, if a country were to get out of the euro, what kind of exchange rate regime would you use? And would you go for Keynes's plan? So for example, so you have both aspects in that book, and that's what I really like in it. It's related to the real world, but you also have theories that try to fit the real world.
Yeah, there's also formalization.
Yeah.
Well, the co-winner of your Milder Prize 2017 is a book titled Microeconomics of Complex Economies, and in this series we interviewed the authors. And there's a lot of mathematics in this book, and in complexity is described as the discriminant between mainstream and heterodox economics. But in your book, the discriminant is probably something else, not complexity. How would you define your book in terms of why it's not a mainstream book?
Well, it's not a mainstream book because the topics, the way the topics are being covered are different. The assumptions are different because we try to, just to give an example, we do not assume in that book that agents are optimizing, that they are trying all the time to maximize their utility or their satisfaction. We do not assume that they have almost an infinite amount of information and that they are being able to treat that kind of information. In that approach, we assume that people react to disequilibria, to changes, but that they react progressively in an adaptive way. And in fact, this is very similar to the complexity economics that you were talking about. I mean, the only difference is that they assume that there's a large number of agents out there, and they try to do computational economics with simulations and so on. Some post-Keynesians also do that. They're also part of this kind of economics with agent-based modeling and so on, doing simulations. The major difference, perhaps, is that instead of having a multiplicity of agents, usually we assume that there's a couple of classes, say the workers versus the entrepreneurs, perhaps a third class, which would be the rentiers, the people who mostly earn dividend payments and interest payments. So that one could say, well, that is perhaps one difference.
Who is going to use this textbook for? What kind of programs and at what level? And what type of student are you training? I mean, what is going to be the result of using this type of textbook in education of future economists?
Well, the purpose of the book, the target of the book was mainly students who were doing their graduate studies. So master's students or PhD students, but it was also designed for, you know, younger scholars who have heard about post-Keynesian economics, who don't know where to start. And so with the book, they are being given the main references. What are the main papers, the main articles, the main books that they ought to look at? There's a very large references section, bibliography, and so that's the purpose. The purpose is to help people who are interested in post-Keynesian economics but do not know where to start. It's to give them a way to start reading about it and finding what are the major authors.
So once again, Mark, you're very Keynesian in the sense that you're modest like a dentist. And because I think I heard many colleagues saying that Your book is not only for students, it's also for colleagues. And I heard many experienced colleagues who said that they discovered something in your book, including well-established professors.
Very interesting. Congratulations again. So what if this book had inspired people that are now leading central banks, international monetary funds, or our governments? What they would have done differently during the crisis, for example, or before the crisis?
Well, I think one of the distinctive feature between heterodox economics and orthodox economics is that there's the belief among heterodox economists that the capitalist system has to be tamed, that it has to be regulated, and there's also the belief that that the system doesn't necessarily drive us towards a high level of employment or full employment, and that it doesn't necessarily, it isn't necessarily stable. So you ask me, you know, what would central bankers do with this kind of view? Well, then you start with the idea that, for instance, the financial system is probably unstable. Maybe it doesn't show at a moment of time, but through time, it's very likely that it will become unstable if it is not well regulated and tamed. And then, therefore, if you put up regulations, then these regulations have to be designed in such a way that you know that there's going to be a problem in the future, and not believing that financial markets are fully efficient.
Well, let me go to
if I may, now it seems that central banks are taking your approach, our approach, seriously, because many central banks now are trying to build stock flow consistent models that were invented by Wayne Godley and Marc Lavoie, and that are explained in the book. For example, here, the Central Bank of Hungary, but also the Bank of England, the Division of Financial Stability, and other central banks want this kind of models. So, and it says they have also become very influential in the French Agency for Development. So maybe now that the crisis is past, we'll see some changes from the point of view of central banks, because many central bankers have realized that they couldn't go on with simple models where the banking sector was non-existent or trivial.
Very good. So if I may go to one of your sections in the introductory chapter, this is titled Four Paradoxes Tied to the Financial System. In fact, I found probably five paradoxes. Do you want to tell us anything about those paradoxes?
Yes. Well, the first paradox is the... I'm not sure I remember them all, but the first paradox essentially is the one that has been underlined by Hyman Minsky. So this is related to what I was just discussing. It's called the paradox of tranquility. It's the idea that the more things look tranquil, the more things seem to be going smoothly, the more likely it will become unstable. So this is certainly one of the paradox. There's another paradox, which is called the paradox of debt, which is the fact that as people or firms try to deleverage, try to reduce their debt, this may in fact slow down the economy. And at the end of this process, the debt ratio may rise instead of going down. In fact, we also have the public finance equivalents of this. Just take the case of Greece, where the Greeks were being ordered to do fiscal austerity, reduce their government debt and reduce their government deficit. But the consequence of that was to raise the debt to GDP ratio. I mean, this is what has been observed in the case of Greece.
And in the case of Portugal, it's the contrary. Now they have stopped these austerity policies, their debt is going down.
Right. So, of course, yeah, you can look at it the other way. There are a few other paradoxes. One that is not in the book, but that I came across afterwards, is the paradox of degrading standards. So what this means is that when the standards for making loans are going down, then more people are getting loans, but many of them not credit worthy. However, the fact that all these people can purchase houses or purchase financial assets is pushing up the prices of these things. And so the bankers have the impression that, well, everything is going nicely. Everything is perfect. All these prices are going up. Whereas in fact, we are just on the verge of all these people defaulting in the near future. So that's another paradox. You get the impression that everything is going well, but in fact, it will not. And that's because all these banks have taken the wrong decisions.
When we discuss about paradoxes, how can we explain them? Is it the cognitive bias? Is it asymmetric information? Is it just wrong regulation? We just awarded the Nobel Prize to Richard Taylor. I don't know if you want to position our thought about paradoxes into this, for example.
Well, there's maybe one paradox that can be associated with some of these people who are doing behavioral economics. But in general, I would not say it is not associated with necessarily misguided behavior or irrational behavior. It is associated with the macro economy. The fact that what one person does, if everybody tries to do one thing, you might get an opposite result. I mean, the best known example of this is the paradox of thrift, where for each of us, it is a good thing to save more because each of us is likely to become more wealthy. But if everybody simultaneously tries to save more, then the consequence will be a slowdown in the economy. And at the end, none of us will be richer. I mean, the economy as a whole will become poorer. So it is not related to, as I said, it's not related to misguided behavior or irrational behavior.
On the contrary, you could say the same thing about the paradox of cost.
Yes, there's also the paradox of cost, which is that it seems to be a good thing for every firm to reduce the wages of its employees, that they will be making more profit. But if all the firms do this simultaneously, and this was pointed out by Mikhail Kaletsky in the 1930s, if all the firms try to reduce the wages, then at the end, all these people will not be able to consume anymore. So consumption will go down and therefore investment will go down. And at the end, the profits of the firm will be going down as well. So again, it's, you know, what seems to be good at the micro level is likely to turn out to have a quite different result at the macroeconomic level.
And maybe there is a paradox of the so-called Nobel Prize in economics, because they gave it to a monetarist. Well, monetarism basically is dead.
Well, much of what you said is about the interaction between micro level. And yesterday, Wolfram and the other authors of the book on complexity and microeconomics of complex economies, they told us that somehow this divide between micro analysis, at least from their point of view, it is becoming less important because of the ability to study more the interaction between the two levels.
Well, yes. In complexity economics, it is claimed that when you sum up all these multiple agents, you will come up with what they call emerging properties. Well, in post-Keynesian economics, basically, we call those macroeconomic paradoxes.
Well, I don't know if you mentioned this explicitly in the book, but maybe I'm going to make a controversial and difficult question, which is about the European Union. I probably assume we don't have the same opinion on the European Union as an institution, and as a regulator. We know that Britain is leaving, and we also know that Britain influenced very much the European Union and the construction of the single market and the ideology which is behind the single market. How do you expect the European Union to change its regulatory framework and its policies and its ideology, if we want to call it an ideology, when Britain will leave?
Well, frankly, I don't think there's going to be much of a change at the level of the European Union. It seems to me that it's not only the British that had these neoliberal ideas. There were also a lot of French or German civil servants who had very similar views. So I doubt that much will be changing on that front because of Brexit.
I pretty much share that point of view. And what we have in the European Union is not the traditional view, the English Anglo-Saxon view of liberalism. It's the ordo-liberal version that we have. So a more German version, or at least some version of ordo-liberalism that wants to put rules everywhere. And we can see that in the fiscal compact. So the British leaving will not change anything. Except that maybe the British leader will not go back home after the European summit and say, okay, I won, and I saved money and I obtained cuts. But the result will be the same.
What would be the change of policy suggested by a post-Keynesian approach like yours, a change in policy at the European level?
Well, a lot of post-Keynesians would argue that the Eurozone construction is a mistake, that it's a little bit like a prison in the sense that once you are in the Eurozone, you cannot get out of it. There's no way you can readjust prices or wages, the competitive aspects. There's the fact that governments don't have a sovereign currency anymore. In other countries, the central bank can always intervene, purchase bonds directly on the primary market if they wish to do so, in order to keep interest rates low. I mean, we had this incredible experience in 2010 when interest rates in Spain, for instance, went up to 7% long-term interest rates, whereas in the UK, they had a similar current account deficit. They had a similar government deficit, and in the UK, interest rates remain around 2%. So why was that? Well, it was because of the existence of this Eurozone and the perception by speculators that if they were attacking the Spaniard government bonds or securities, that the central bank wouldn't be able to do enough or wouldn't want to do what the Bank of England could do in the case of the UK. So that's one issue. And then the second issue, which we mentioned briefly before, is all those rules, fiscal rules, which are being imposed on the European governments, which stop them from having expansionary fiscal policies, even in times where the rates of interest are next to zero. And despite that, we are still being told that these governments cannot go forward and try to have an expansion of the economic activity. So that's the drawback of the European Union construction.
I would pretty much agree, but I would add something that I discovered in your book is that when you look at the European payment system called Target 2, there are lots of similarities with the Keynes plan, and that we could use Target 2 and under its current structure to force the surplus countries that have a commercial surplus to adjust. So we could transform, if there was a political will, the EU and use Target 2 in order to have a kind of Keynes plan. That I discovered in your book, and honestly, it's pretty much convincing.
Yes, there's one thing that works well. It's this clearing and settlement system between the various banks inside the Eurozone. That works very well. And if there is a country that has a deficit, it doesn't create a problem through this clearing and settlement system. And the drawback is that there is nothing apparently that can be done to convince the countries that have large trade surpluses to engage in expansionary activities, expansionary fiscal policy, so that this would help the other countries, mostly from the south of Europe, who have a trade deficit.
Well, in this conversation about ideas and policies and institutions, where would you put Canada? Because it's very close. Well, it's bordering with the United States. We always mention it as belonging to the Anglo-Saxon cluster of nations. But politically now it's very different to both what is happening in England and the United States. So in terms of economics and ideas, where would you collocate Canada? Well, by the way, the central banker of the Bank of England is Canadian.
Yes, the governor of the Bank of England, Mark Carney, is a Canadian. Maybe Canada is somewhere in between the Anglo-Saxon world and the European, continental European world. But for 7 or 8 years, we had very similar policies as in Europe. I mean, the target was to get a zero deficit, and except, of course, during the 2009, right after the Lehman Brothers crisis, where all the countries agreed to go into this expansionary fiscal policy for about 16 months. Now we have a new government, the Liberal government. They campaign saying that they would agree to have a small deficit, you know, about 1% of GDP or 0.5% of GDP. And to some extent, they got elected through this promise, you know, that they would do some expansionary policy. Whereas, strangely enough, the party that was most to the left wing, in Canada you're never very far from the center, they were advocating a balanced budget. And to some extent they got beaten because of that, because they were the favorite at the beginning of the campaign.
What a post-Keynesian approach would say about international trade. We know that Trump is threatening to reverse the globalization, or at least to protect the United States from completely free trades. Britain is willing to, apparently in the propaganda, is willing to open itself to trades and to benefit from leaving the European Union with respect to trades. We know that Canada has recently signed an agreement with the European Union, but at the same time, Canadian investments in Britain are now threatened by Trump because of the levies on Bombardier, for example. So how a post-Keynesian approach would see this? Another war of ideas, more or less.
Well, Danny usually teaches this part of the book.
Yeah, it's chapter 7, and it's Marx's book, so...
Yeah, it's a delicate topic. I mean, basically, the point of view of the post-Keynesians is that they are very wary of this free trade ideology. So the argument is that all these theorems that exist in neoclassical economics about all the good things that brings free capital flow and free trade, that these positive arguments can be easily reversed. I mean, basically, I would think that post-Keynesians are in favor of some protectionism. The argument being that a country that has some protection will be able to expand its economy more than if it has a complete open economy. And therefore, and that's the paradox, despite protectionism, this has a favorable effect on the overall economy because of these positive effects on aggregate demand. I mean, if the United States are able to have more expansion of their economy because of some form of protectionism, then the idea is that this, because they will have a much faster rate of growth, then this will have feedback effects on all the other economies, and eventually the size of the exports would be bigger, would be larger with protectionism, some form of protectionism, than with having just total free trade.
Yeah, but this was a point already made by Paul Bayrock in his book. Here in Marx's book, you find the theory behind it, and you find many arguments showing that maybe free trade is not always the best solution. And if I may refer to a paper that is not in your book, but I think you like it too, it's a paper by Selva Storm called CETA, the agreement we were talking about between Canada and Europe, CETA without blinders. And I think that paper is very interesting. It's a post-Keynesian paper and dealing with these kind of issues and showing the possible effects of CETA, and they're not so positive.
Yeah, the other feature is that there's the belief, I mean, there's some link here with Marxist theory. There's a belief that because of free trade, this gives more power to the large corporations, which allows them to reduce the share of wages in the economy. And within those post-Keynesian models, if you reduce the share of wages in the world economy, then this reduces either the level of output of the world economy or reduces the rate of growth of the world economy. So this is another reason for which post-Keynesians are wary of free trade, because it has those negative income distribution effects, which then have a negative impact on the growth rate or the level of output.
Well, this was a very interesting conversation. Thank you very much for your time. So we have a paper suggestion by Danny on the CETA agreement, and we have a very big book recommendations. The book title is Post-Keynesian Economics, New Foundations, and it has been published in 2015 by Edward Elgar. Thank you very much for being here, for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you.